This is Pure Decking, show number 408 for Thursday. I don't know what today is. The 10th? Whatever. Whatever it is. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game, and trying to find a new game that's not Minecraft plus leveling. I'm Morps. Tonight, we have Aryu. What is up, Aryu?
Not much, my friend. Not much at all.
And we have Madman. What is up,
Hola. Madman? I do believe it's the 115th day of fire in the year of our Lord Trump.
I gotta start saying that after a day, year of our Lord Trump, just to see who loses their mind. I actually found on Thingiverse that Emperor Trump bust. Somebody took a scan of a Julius Caesar bust and put Trump's head on it. I had to print a couple of those out for like my dad. He's going to use them to taunt people. It's going to be hilarious.
But he taunts, in air quotes, the right people, if you know what I mean, so he doesn't end up getting shot.
No. It's not like that. The person he's going to taunt with it is not, not likely to retaliate in the way you're thinking.
Mentally stable.
Yes.
You're just going to be putting Biden stickers all over his cars.
Yeah, he might, actually. So...
Now, that is a proper response.
At least his car won't get smashed in any car park, you know, if he had a Trump sticker on it.
Well, hell, it'd be like when we were going to university and the guy was going around putting, was it carry stickers on everybody's car? Like, just going in the parking garage, just on everybody's fucking car, carry sticker. It's like, good God, man.
That's when I beat the man to death. Not because he put a political sticker on my car, just because he touched my car.
Yeah.
The right to touch people's shit.
So. Yep, what did I do? There it goes. Lost the tag.
Break it.
Fucking broke it! You broke it! Yeah. Get the links in
here. We're not breaking shit.
So, let's get into it here. First article I have is from CNBC. Amazon is filled with fake reviews. No shit. I mean, seriously.
Can't go and buy one? I mean, there aren't companies selling reviews on Amazon?
No.
For real?
No. Since Amazon early days, reviews are the one big metric customers have relied on to determine the quality and authenticity of a product. Amazon's listings have often have hundreds of thousands of reviews, instead of the handful found on competing marketplaces. But many of those reviews can't be trusted. Thousands of fake reviews have flooded Amazon, Walmart, eBay, and others as sales have skyrocketed. From Facebook groups where bad actors solicited paid positive reviews to bots and click farms that upvote negative reviews to take out the competition, fake reviews are getting harder to spot. In July, UCLA and USC released a study that found that more than 20 fake review-related Facebook groups with an average of 16,000 members. In more than 560 postings each day, sellers offered a refund or payment for a positive review, usually around $6. Well, I mean, shit, if you're sitting there doing reviews all day and you're getting $6 a piece, I mean, that's... you can make some money.
Change. Yeah.
Not a bad second job.
Yeah. Repercussions are getting more serious, too, as shoppers stay home and increasingly turn online for things they'd normally want to shop for in person. Recent months, fake reviews have boosted the sales of unsafe products and hurt businesses for legitimate sellers, causing huge brands to sever ties with Amazon. Amazon told CNBC that it uses powerful machine learning tools and skilled investigators to analyze over 10 million review submissions weekly, aiming to stop abusive reviews before they're ever published. Well, it's not the abusive ones I care about. It's the fake ones saying the product's A-OK and safe when the thing's actually a fire hazard. Usually those are easy to spot, but still. Still, the company recently removed 20,000 reviews after an investigation found that the top Amazon reviewers in the UK were engaging in fraud. And, yeah, they got a video here talking about it. We're not gonna play the video, but, I mean, is anybody surprised? Of course there are fake reviews. Really? So,
I actually think this is broke before.
It's been broken for a long time.
Wasn't Yelp just like a mafia-style standover thing? Buy our ads or get a bad review?
It turned into that.
Yeah.
I think originally when it first started, it was honest. But with the Amazon reviews, you know, it's always great when you see a brand new product and it's already got, you know, thousands. Usually it's not thousands. Usually it's a couple of hundred positive reviews. And the fake ones are usually pretty easy to spot. It's like, oh, this product is wonderful and changed my life. And, you know, it's never anything. The easy giveaway is it's never anything specific about the thing.
Yeah, my pickup truck started, my wife rose from the dead, and my dog came back.
Yeah, it's shit like
that. That's how good this product is, yeah.
But it's never actually anything specific about it. And it is kind of fun when you're looking at 3D printer parts and it says something like, oh, yeah, this improved my life. It's like, okay, I'm into 3D printing, but come on. So
I was able to print a Ferrari with this car. With this printer.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, you know, usually the broken English is a pretty good giveaway, too, that these things are, you know, they're written like that on purpose because they're generic. So what it is they've paid somebody for 100 positive reviews of their product the moment that it goes up, so it, you know, has a good ranking as soon as it goes up. So what I like to do is look for ones where, you know, not so much the quantity of reviews, because you can discount usually the couple hundred positive reviews that give it 5 stars that don't say anything. Usually the 3-star and the 2-star are the reviews you actually want to look at, because they'll say verified purchase, but 9 times out of 10, that's bullshit. I don't quite know how they're faking that one, but there's a way to do it, obviously. But, you know, the 2- and 3-star reviews, that's where you get the actual, like, what's going on with it, right? Because usually they'll be like, yeah, it works, but I had the issue with this and this. Okay, that's actually useful. The 2-star, yeah, it doesn't, you know, it only worked for a month and then it quit. Okay, that's useful. But when you go into the 1-star reviews, you know, you'll be looking at a part and it'll be like, well, it just didn't work. And you'll get all these reviews from, you know, either one, spam bots trying to downvote a product, but usually that's fairly obvious. Or two, people who obviously don't know how to use it. But the weird one is when they have all the questions on there about a product. And you'll see shit like, you know, it'll have a question on there, and then the answer is, I don't know, I didn't order this. And it's like, what the hell? So Amazon's using some kind of a botting system to send these questions about a product, not back to the company, but to other people it thinks have purchased something, right? Yep. And I don't get that, because you're not, then you're depending on other people to answer questions about it, and you're going to get bullshit in those. So I don't know anymore, unless it's a name brand, it's a gamble. You know, it's probably going to be made of premium grade Chinesium and last about 20 minutes. You know, unless it's a name brand or something that you know what it is, in which case then you're just buying whatever it is online. But yeah, when you're ordering the Harvey Danielson motorcycles online, that's it's probably not as good as as the genuine article. Just gonna say.
But does it look cool and drive 170 miles an hour?
Yep, once.
That's all you really need to do. 170. Just that one time.
Just the once. Then you park it in the driveway and occasionally pose next to it for your Instagram. So I don't know. This isn't surprising to me at all. They're saying, oh, they're getting harder to spot. Well, that just means your click farms are getting better at writing scripts. Or they're just going on Facebook and paying people for it. And again, people are doing $6 a review. I mean, no wonder, right? That's not bad. If you're sitting there doing tons of reviews all day, I could see somebody making some money doing that.
Especially since a lot of it's going to be copy-paste.
Oh, yeah. Even if it's not like a Python script bot, you could definitely do something like AutoIt, which, for anybody who's not familiar with that one, it's a scripting system specifically for interacting with Windows. Like, you can write commands about move the mouse from this window to this window, you know, click on this bit of text kind of thing. So it's useful for automating tasks that don't have an API or a direct way to automate it, because it basically is automating things like what a user would do. And also, people use it for writing bots for video games. So, and occasional malware, so your AV may flag it if you want to play with AutoIt. But, if I was doing a review farm, that's how I would do it. Something like AutoIt, so it at least looks like legit reviews, because then I'm not interacting with an API or something like that to make it, very obvious. At least it's still a real browser doing the entry, even if it is automated and copy-paste, right?
Yeah.
Of course, the trick there is the same thing I have when I'm doing spam filtering at work. If somebody's posted the same exact text 1,000 times, it's usually pretty easy to go, oh, it's a bot, and just delete all of it, right? So usually you want it to have it varied. And actually, it reminds me of when I caught it at work one time. We caught it because it was all coming from the same sender address. But it was actually kind of a pain in the ass to clean up, because until I figured out, the same server and message ID, basically, the text of the message was approximately the same sentence that it sent to everybody, but they had put together, how would you put it? I guess a template sentence of click this link to get your message, right? But they had reworded every part of it and had, for each chunk of the sentence, which was about, getting somebody to click a link, they had rewritten, they had like 10 different versions of each chunk of the sentence, so that their script was randomly selecting, A, B, C, D. And then when you put it together, it was roughly English and basically said, click the link and give us your password, to view your document kind of thing. But it had hundreds of different permutations when I was looking through it, because I was trying to find a common thing to search on. And the link was a good one. They all ultimately went back to the same link. So that was the other way we found the rest of them, because most of them were coming from the same server and same message ID. But It was an interesting trick, because I hadn't seen that one done before, but you could apply the same thing to these reviews, right? You put together some generic reviews and then just have a bunch of these chunks of sentence that roughly mean the same thing but use different words, so at least it looks different text, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm not explaining this well, am I?
No, I know what you're saying, man. I'm hearing it.
Yeah. So
9 out of 10 automated response is saying the exact same thing.
Yeah, just
arranged differently and then rigged up to a script to start spitting them out. $6 a bit.
Yeah, there's a bunch of synonyms basically for phrases in the sentence, and it had several it was picking from. And once you kind of figured out the pattern, it was like, oh, that is cool. It's a dumb trick, because it's just string concatenation with a little bit of random number thrown in, but it's very well done from a social engineering standpoint. So,
well, if you're not used to it, man.
Oh, yeah. If you don't know what to look for, I mean, that's hard to catch. Yeah. Madman, anything on that? Or
No, I think we covered it with the whole, this has been happening for a while and no one is surprised.
Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
All right, well, here's one that's not been happening for a while. And again, nobody is surprised, but this one is actually kind of new. I've seen this myself recently, so this is from mspoweruser.com. So the headline is, Microsoft Defender falsely reports you are infected if you try to block Microsoft telemetry and ads with the host's file. Because I was getting alerts on my host file. I'm like, why is this complaining about my host file? There's nothing in it except the stuff that one of my cleanup scripts put in it, which is just blocking the Microsoft servers. Well, if there's anything in the host file now, it's basically, you know, flagging it. And even if you tell it to allow the edits, actually, I didn't check it after the last time. I'm going to go in and double check it right now because I got the alert twice. The first time I got the alert, I allowed it, and it didn't mess with it. Or no, that's not right. It reset it back to the blank, even though I told it to allow it. And I put it back, and then I got the alert again yesterday. So if you're running like ShutUp 10 or any of these other things that supposedly block the Microsoft telemetry, it'll put entries in the host file to block all the Microsoft telemetry servers. Well, Defender is now flagging that as malware, which is just frustrating. Because it's
Microsoft,
like,
man.
It's like, oh, you're blocking this? Yeah, that's a. Oh, that's against the law. You know. Oh, what did I do? Oh shit! My browser just crashed. One moment.
Lose all your tabs.
This is why we make show notes. Hang on.
That's Microsoft for you, man. False positives. Yeah. Ridiculous. There's nothing you can do either. Unless you've got the answer and you can tell us next. How to fix this.
Allow the host file and then edit it again, which is what I've had to do twice already.
Yes.
Because it goes ahead and clears it out even if you tell it to allow it. But, oh no, it didn't. It didn't. Okay. It left it alone the second time. Yeah, the first time it did. These were actually put in. Oh, okay, that's right. Yeah, this was Spybot Anti-Beacon is what put these entries in. But, yeah, so let's do let's see the text here. The article says, editing your host file is one way to block Microsoft telemetry and Microsoft-delivered ads on Windows. And it turns out Microsoft is not too happy with it. The latest versions of Microsoft Defender for Windows 10 will detect if you are adding entries to your host file, which would block Microsoft's servers and refused to allow you to save the file, claiming it's a severe security risk. Yeah, a severe security risk to our bottom line. I tell you, all this telemetry shit, and all this auto update, all, you know, everything forcing itself to being online all the time. It's looking more and more like everybody ought to be running Linux as their core OS, and then running Windows in a VM safely bundled up where it can do no harm. of course, you want to play games on it, then you need 3D, and that's harder to pull off with a VM. But Linux gaming has come a long way too, so I'm hoping that gets more and more common because this Windows 10 shit is getting stupid. In fact, Microsoft will claim you are infected with settings modifier Win32 host file hijack, which a Google search reveals has caused several users to panic and believe they have a virus. So, yeah, just because they've edited their host file or a tool has edited it for them and they didn't understand what was going on. With Microsoft weaving Windows Defender even more deeply into Windows, it does bring to mind the question of who is actually controls the PC you are using. So, you know, they've got some text from a forum where somebody's panicking, and they said, I know what the host file is, and I allowed it, but I don't know what's going on. I don't have a virus, do I? And, you know, scaring people, basically.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you're blocking the telemetry? That's not allowed. I mean, you know, that's what it is. That's what they're doing. So,
what other edits can you do the host file?
Well, I mean, are you familiar with what the host file is? I guess I should explain it anyways for listeners. So the host file is an interesting remnant of the TCP/IP stack. More specifically, the BSD implementation of the TCP/IP stack, which is kind of the reference implementation that everybody else based their design off of. And likely an indicator that Microsoft may have borrowed some source code when they were writing the original implementations for Windows 2000 and Windows. Did 98 have TCP? I think it did. I think you could get TCP in 98. I don't remember if you could get it in 95 or if 95 was NetBIOS only. It's been too long. Anyways, so the hosts file was the first form of DNS. So before they came up with the idea of a DNS server, you know, this is back in the day when there were, you know, a handful of hosts on the internet, maybe a couple hundred, and you could manage this stuff with a local text file. So all it is, you know, a text file that has a bunch of entries, which is domain name, tab, IP address. No, wait, that's backwards. It's IP address and domain name. Fuck. Now I've forgotten which way around it goes. One moment. I'm just going to pull up my host file and look. Yeah, it's IP address, then domain name. There we go. So pretty much what this lets you do is, let's say I don't want to load ads1.msn.com. So what I can do is I can go into a host file, in my host file, which in Linux is actually under switch etc switch hosts, and on Windows it's under C Windows sys32 drivers etc, and then there's just a text file in there called hosts. So what you can do is say the IP address, instead of putting a real one in, you just put 0.0.0.0.0.0.0 so that the name of ads.msn.com will now resolve to all zeros, or a null address that obviously doesn't load. So what this lets you do is kind of a poor man's ad block, because instead of loading this stuff at a network level, your TCP stack in the OS, the actual TCP driver, checks the host file, then it checks domain servers when it's trying to resolve a host name. So the other nice thing is, if you have a local network and you've got some different IP addresses, you can use the host file to point, like, Google to a different host. So there is an actual legitimate reason to look at the host file to see if you have malware. That used to be one of the old things that a lot of adware would do back in the day, is they would point all of the major search engines and antivirus sites to go to the, like, at the fake AV programs. They would go into your host file and point, like, you know, Norton.com, Microsoft.com, all these things to go to the fake AV site, with the message, oh, you tried to go to such and such. Well, obviously, they recommend using our, you know, fake, super duper, steal your information, charge you $500 antivirus, fake antivirus, right? So that was one of the things they used to do back in the day, was put shit in host file. Nowadays, you can still do it, but a lot less people do. You know, they'll install Adblock Plus in their browser and call it a day. But if you do it at the host file level, you're actually doing it at a network level. So it's below that. It's actually at the application level. And what's really interesting is some things will respect that host file and other things won't. I've noticed on certain devices, specifically I'm thinking of an Android box I had with the YouTube app on it, even though I had actually gone into that Android stack at a network level and blocked some specific, that were the ad servers for YouTube, the YouTube app would still play those ads. And I watched the network traffic and figured out it wasn't doing regular DNS calls, and it wasn't doing host file lookups. It has its own, it already has the addresses built into it so that you can't pull that kind of shenanigan on it, unfortunately. Or at least that's what it was when I tested it a couple of years ago. So putting all the Microsoft telemetry servers in the host file is kind of a good way to you know, block all that shit on your machine. Now, the downside is if you have something that's expecting an answer from those telemetry servers, say the Photos app, you'll discover it hangs, like, a lot. And you'll have to switch to InfraView view or something, because as more and more of these default Windows programs depend on checking in with the cloud, you'll find they just don't work when you don't let your system, you know, shluff all your data back up to Microsoft. So, you know, running Windows without having it, you know, contacting Microsoft all the bleeding time is getting harder and harder, to the point that, like I said, yeah, we all probably ought to be looking at switch over to, yeah, I mean, everybody should probably be looking over to switch over to Linux at some point, because, I mean, Mac is less obnoxious about it. They still do it with the iCloud stuff, but I don't, outside of some other small, you know, other alternative operating systems, Linux is the only major one I can think of that give, I mean, BSD, I guess, but, you know, that's kind of in that similar camp. I don't want to say the same camp. I'll have pitchforks and torches outside if I say that, but, you know, it's in a similar boat of, you know, the open source the open source software stacks are about the only place where you still have that, you know, system-level computing rather than account-level computing, like we were talking about a couple of weeks ago.
The reason I was asking is, was there a legitimate reason for them to actually check that file? Is it like...
Oh, yeah, malware used to do the same thing, where you would block legitimate sites and force... You could... Because I'm using... You know, the thing you do today is you use it to block ad servers and telemetry servers and shit like that. back in the day when we used to pirate some of the Adobe software, you would put their registration servers in there so the software could never check in and prove that you had a you know, the key that came with it rather than one that you had purchased.
Ooh. Things stopped checking for that attack. That might be something for hackers to start doing again.
Well, that's just it, right? Is, I mean, malware to this day still does that. It's just not nearly as common as it used to be. Most antivirus software looks at the host file. So, usually seeing something all zeroed out is not a big deal, because that means that you know it's just not going to load. You're actively trying to block a URL. It's when you see it redirecting someplace it shouldn't go that it's a problem. So I wouldn't expect a malware program to care that you had a whole bunch of domain names with all zeros in front of them, because that just means don't load it, right? It's when you have some other random address out there on the internet. You know, hell, that was a prank we played on some people at work back in the day, is we'd go in their host file and point Google to, like, Bing. Just to mess with them, see who noticed kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, you can't pull that trick anymore because there's so much crap integrated with Google that, you know, if you do that, their Chrome browser doesn't load. That's interesting, isn't it? So.
Always up to fuckery.
Yeah, anymore. So, anything else on that, or have I beaten that horse to glue?
I'm good.
You may be able to steal some envelopes.
Next one up, this is from Habber.com, and this is an interesting write-up. The Hunt for Vulnerability, Executing Arbitrary Code on NVIDIA GeForce Now Virtual Machines. This write-up is fun. So, pretty much, they start explaining GeForce Now and how at the time they did the tests, they had, you know, the free service and the paid service, which, actually, I don't know if that's even still being offered or not. For anybody who's not aware of it, GeForce Now was this, it was sort of like the Google Stadia, or I'm trying to think of who else was doing this, but you could get a cloud-based VM and it would play your games because they had GPUs hooked up to the VMs, and then stream it back to your desktop so you could try to game. And the idea was it would be super low latency. And, but I think you had to buy your games on the system. I don't remember. But anyways, so what these guys did was they signed up for the free account, ran Steam on there, and then started seeing what they could do to explore the system. And Steam has the option to add third-party programs to the launcher, right? So they, of course, they tried to add command.com, and that was denied. So they've got some things in there blocking. But they figured out they could add 7-Zip, because 7-Zip was installed on the machines. When anybody's used 7-Zip knows, 7-Zip is not just a zip program. It's an Explorer replacement. You can run programs through it, launch things, get out of the zip file, right? Which, obviously, it was installed on there because I think it's some of its libraries are used in some of the installers for different games. So using that, they were able to get out of Steam and explore around the system and got the command shell, figured out that it's running Windows Server 2019. What they weren't able to do was get any kind of a payload delivered up to... delivered up to the VM. They were still messing with that. But they did send a report to NVIDIA, and NVIDIA's fixed it already. But it was... It's a really fun write-up of how to go about exploring one of these systems where you're supposed to be locked into one little area and ways you can usually use to get out of that. It kind of reminds me of some shit I used to do back in the day when I worked at a grocery store. At the front desk, they had a Ticketmaster kiosk, which, if anybody's ever worked one of those, it's a PC running a terminal program, right? And you're only supposed to be able to do Ticketmaster stuff on it because they've got Windows all, you know, they did the old school registry hacks and replaced Explorer, so it only ran their program. Well, turned out, if you went into the help for the Ticketmaster program, it used a standard Windows help file viewer. Well, the standard Windows help file viewer on Windows 95 had the option to open other help files. So you could use that file open. And from file open, you basically had a crippled Explorer window. And you could use that to break out of the Ticketmaster program and start exploring the system. Then I discovered I was obviously not the first person to do this because other people had loaded games on the system. So, good times, you know. I mean, this kind of shit we used to do back in school, too. It'd be to break out of the protected program so you could do whatever you wanted on the system.
Little part of the game, man.
Isn't it?
Yep.
So I played
solitaire on the machine we used to wire transfers.
It's not my network. I will fuck with it as much as I can.
Oh, dude, I found Leisure Suit Larry, some NES emulators, bunch of crap on that machine. Hell, I had it playing the old Uplink game, if anybody remembers that, for a while, just because I thought it was funny as hell. But, anyways, I just thought this was fun because they were exploiting, you know, Steam to break out of, you know, the protected GeForce Now environment and be able to explore the system a little bit. But NVIDIA themselves, according to their FAQ, actually don't consider getting into CMD.exe a vulnerability because apparently some of the games need it to do things. But they did manage to... they figured out that the thing kills their connection immediately once they try to launch something a little bit more privileged, like, say, PowerShell. So...
that's something they may have already been watching for?
Mm-hmm. Well, what they've done is they've got a watchdog program on these things, and if they see it run something it's not supposed to, it just shuts the machine down. Standard whitelisting, really. But they were trying to find a way around it, and... they were playing around with DLL injection into Counter-Strike, trying to get it to launch other things. And they were able to get that to actually work by injecting code into Counter-Strike. But again, it wasn't terribly useful because they still didn't escape the VM or anything like that, but they were able to get code execution. So I just thought it was an interesting write-up, and it kind of reminded me of the old days of just breaking out of a protected interface. So,
back before you were the guy putting up that protected interface.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how do you think you get the job?
Yo.
See, how would I have done that? They do it the same way? Damn it, no. Good news, I get to learn something new today.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of how it works. But the other cool thing would be, you know, something like GeForce Now, the nice trick to that is you're supposedly able to game on devices you wouldn't normally be able to game on, or if you know, that might be how you end up doing it. If you're going to go Linux full time, would be to use, you know, one of these gaming servers out there to be able to, you know, run your stuff that won't run under Linux cleanly that way. Of course, then you got to pay for a cloud service, or I guess Steam does the link thing, Steam Link. So that might be a way to do it. Just have two machines, have your real machine, then have your gaming rig in the closet. Just stream everything. Of course, you still have a Windows box in that background, but it's not doing anything. So, you know, is it that big of an issue? Although, how long before these things start scanning the network to find other devices and trying to pull data off them if you're not doing anything with that particular device?
Don't. Yeah, just don't.
I mean, I wouldn't put it past them.
Just.
That has got to. I'd have to say that's got to be illegal. But
no, it's not. They'll bury it in EULA.
It is going to get to the point where you're just going to connect one device at a time via hard connection.
You just have to watch its traffic for a week before you trust it to go into the real network.
Dude, you know what I mean? Like, fuck.
Well,
how
that
far do I have? Like, I was going to make an analogy, but it doesn't really work out.
Well, you just have to start segmenting everything on your network at home.
Oh. They get straight
yeah.
to the cable modem and see, are you going to try to scan my entire IP provider's network?
Well, I mean, fuck. Back in the day, I called our ISP trying to scan our network internally. I mean, I still see that occasionally. Actually, you know, that is one good thing about Charter, is I haven't caught them trying to do that yet. Comcast and Time Warner, though, both of them tried. Routinely tried to scan our network internally. I never understood what they were trying to accomplish with that either. It's like, why do you care? But,
product.
I think
you product.
That, or it's a leftover from back in the day when they used to say, oh, we support up to 5 devices on your internet connection or something like that. You know, trying to see who's doing more than their allocated amount.
Yeah.
Of course, you put a fucking NAT firewall in front of it. I've got one device, as far as you can tell. It's like, we think you're using more. Prove it. You know? Of course, that's never how
you're
those conversations
in Britain,
go.
They'll just kick your front fucking door in.
Oh, yeah, they have the TV license. They can go suck a dick.
Well, isn't that just if you watch that one movie on Netflix as you get your door kicked in? Or is that.
The UK, you got to pay. I think it's £250 a year.
Oh, for each screen. Yeah, the TV tax.
Yeah. And they will kick your fucking door in.
It's like, I don't have a TV. You get a laptop. I don't watch TV on it. It runs DOS.
Fucking speak and spell.
And for a while, they had vans driving around scanning houses for TV.
I believe it. All right, let's move on. Next one. This is one RU sent me from abc.net.au. Service NSW confirms 180,000 customers' personal details exposed in cybersecurity breach. Whoops. More than 180,000 New South Wales residents are believed to have been caught up in a major cybersecurity breach after a state government department was compromised earlier this year. Service NSW on Monday morning confirmed the large number of people likely impacted in the breach, which was first reported publicly by the government in May. Those caught up in the criminal attack are now set to be informed by the department via registered post in the coming days. Service NSW Chief Executive Damon Rees confirmed the scale of the incident in a statement saying millions of documents may have been compromised. The investigation, which began in April, engaged forensic specialists to analyze 3.8 million documents in the accounts, he said. This rigorous first step surfaced about 500,000 documents, which referenced personal information. Mr. Rees said the data compromised documents such as handwritten notes and forms, scans, and records and transaction applications. Across the last 4 months, some of the analysis has included manual review of tens of thousands of records to ensure our customer care teams could develop a robust and useful notification process. We are sorry that customers' information was taken in this way. So it sounds like just a general smattering of documents, but I'm betting this is, you know, since they're talking about setting up for accounts and shit, there's probably enough in here for ID theft, probably people's financials.
No doubt.
Yeah. Incident was discovered after the email accounts of 47 staff members were first compromised in April. 47?
I know, man.
That's impressive. Normally when you're testing these things, you only need to get a handful of email accounts to get in there and start stealing documents. 47 is just flexing.
I'll bet was something around the pay rise. They were getting a pay rise. That would have been the document they clicked on. In the email.
Oh, sure. I mean, HR documents are a goldmine for getting people to click shit.
That's why, for so many people to have been compromised, and I just know around the time when this would have happened was during the pay disputes. So, it was clever.
Well, I mean, every time I've done a phishing test, you know, my most successful ones have always been, like, you know, planned layoffs.xl or XLS.
You know, that is a good one.
Spoof the HR department head's email address. Make it look like they accidentally did a send all instead of just to, one person. That gets a lot of people to click shit. We were using an AWS small for our phishing test and knocked it over with one of those. I wasn't allowed to do the phishing tests anymore. When I worked at the school, I wasn't allowed to do them at all. And I said, well, why not? Because you're going to embarrass people with tenure and doctorates.
Yeah.
Well, they had asked me for samples of what I would send out for phishing tests. And then my boss just said no. Why? Because too many people will fall for it. Well, isn't that the point of doing this?
No, because you embarrass people with pay scales bigger than yours.
Yeah, and they're not going to give us the funding to fix it. So that, you know, it's like, oh, it's a game. Fuck.
So we have to catch enough to show it's a problem, but catch not the people that we're going to catch.
Yeah, well, they, yeah, and I have seen people, how would you put it, pruning the lists of people who clicked on the link. It's like, oh, you can't include the VPs in there. Well, why not? They clicked the link too. They need to do the training just like everybody. No, we can't do that. let's see. Requests by ABC News under Freedom of Information laws for more information about the breach were rejected by the department in July on grounds that the investigation was ongoing. New South Wales police are actively involved in the investigation to determine who accessed the sensitive information. Good fucking luck. Opposition MP Sophie Costas said that the breach was unprecedented. This is extraordinary that this attack has been allowed to happen. No, this is standard business email compromise, lady. This is how it goes.
And I love it. Allowed to happen. It wasn't allowed to happen. It happened. We didn't have a group meeting on Friday and leave you out of it and discuss, man, you know what would be awesome as fuck?
No.
If we got a compromise.
No. See, this is, you're right in that it's a fundamental misunderstanding, but this is a standard management response to
it's your boilerplate.
IT team. You know, it's like, why did you let this happen? Well, I don't know. Why did you let your children drink alcohol on the weekend when you weren't home? It's, you know, you didn't let it happen. It's happened.
It's classic obfuscation.
Of course it is. Look, well, it's blame
shifting.
Why did
you let Hitler take over Europe?
Yeah, well, I don't think you can say anything to Australia about that one. Now, if it was France,
Austria.
Oh, there you go.
was Switzerland. We're gonna sit this one out again.
You know, that's like, yeah. That's like going to the fire department. Well, why did you let my building burn down? Well, I don't know. Why were you smoking cigarettes in bed? I mean, you know, come on. But yeah, it's extraordinary that this attack has been allowed to happen. Yeah. Whether it's births, deaths, and marriages, registration, guardianship information, today people should be questioning whether they trust the information they're providing the government and the security. Well, you should always be questioning the information you provide the government. And the security measures the government is taking to keep their information safe. She also criticized the government for taking 4 months to alert residents. If they're manually reviewing that many documents, it might take somebody that long to get through them all. I mean, that's...
Oh, no. They were waiting for a Sunday evening to let this one out. This was a Friday night, Sunday evening fucking story.
Can somebody go light one of the parklands on fire so we have something to bury this with?
Pretty much.
You know, can we get one of those California-style gender reveal parties out here?
The public getting a little bit fed up with these fucking people.
Has someone bombed something recently? Can we arrange it?
Can we make up some Trump quotes to distract people and then bury this at the bottom of the page?
They haven't mentioned Trump in 2 weeks.
Really?
Not one mention of Trump. Not one mention of American politics, nothing. Because they realize it doesn't fucking rate here.
Well, I have a feeling that everyone there is fucking tired of it.
Oh, yeah, dude, it's so fucking tired of it.
It's like, who the hell cares at some point if they're not... You know, it'd be like asking me about your politics. It's like, I don't care.
Exactly. And as I said, American politics for me is sports ball. I get to follow it. I get to enjoy all the players. And I know when the game's playing, it doesn't matter how yell I loud, other way around. And I'll never have any influence over it.
Yeah. Of course, all we've heard here lately is, oh my God, back in 2018, Trump might have said something off color. It's like, really?
Anyway.
Trump said something off color. You don't say.
Moving along.
Yeah. It's not so much that I care, it's just that I'm tired of it.
Yeah. Fucking tired.
A few more months and we'll be over.
No, it won't, madman. The ride doesn't stop.
It's like, no, you don't understand. Unless our candidate wins, it's violence and the system was rigged. Isn't that how it works?
It's been like this for 10 years now. Fucking hell.
This one's funny. The next one up is from decrypt.co. The IRS is offering $625,000 to crack Monero. The IRS is taking applications from participants who believe they can break Monero's privacy. It is paying out $625,000 in two phases to those who manage to do so. The IRS cited rising cybercrime usage of privacy coins as a motivation behind the proposal. The U.S. Internal Revenue Service will pay out $625,000 for anyone who cracks the untraceable cryptocurrency Monero and other privacy coins, according to an official proposal published last week. IRSCI is seeking a solution with one or more contractors to provide innovative solutions for tracing and attribution of privacy coins, such as expert tools, data, source code, algorithm, and software development services, said the proposal. Privacy coins like Monero allow users to transfer their funds with strong privacy. They use various methods to do this, such as obfuscating the transaction amounts and the wallet address of the sender and receiver. This is unlike Bitcoin or Ethereum, where addresses can be tracked down to known wallets and crypto exchanges and subsequently one's identity. Currently, there are limited investigative resources for tracing transactions involving privacy cryptocurrencies. Coins such as Monero or other off-chain transactions that provide privacy to illicit actors, the IRS added. Under the terms, private contractors and individuals are invited to submit a working prototype of how they intend to crack Monero. These could range from a system that provides identifying information of a Monero wallet user to the exact time, date, and amount for specific transactions on the network, to even more sophisticated tools that can statistically predict when a certain address is likely to make a transaction. At that point, they're just expecting somebody to wave a magic fucking wand. Predict when a certain address is likely to make a transaction. Predict the future. They're asking you to predict the fucking future.
That will only work if you have a lot of that particular wallet's transaction history, and they do regular transactions.
Well, that's one of the things that Monero does, is they generate noise in the chain, and they randomly pad time on the transactions, so that building a record of that transaction activity is difficult. At least an accurate one. The IRS is taking applications until September the 16th for the proposal. Those who take the challenge will receive their bounty in two phases. First, the initial $500,000 payment for developing and providing a working concept of a privacy crack tool, due 8 months after the proposal acceptance, and later, $125,000 payment after a pilot test is completed and approved by the government. The agency noted rising cybercriminal usage for privacy coins like Monero as one of its motivations behind the proposal, stating that privacy coins are becoming more popular and used by more illicit actors, blah, 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 blah. So, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you can crack Monero, couldn't you just take a lot more than $625,000 out of the system? I mean, if you've cracked Monero, wouldn't you just be able to generate a lot more money than that?
Doesn't mean that you're not going to also take that.
There you go. But
like, once I know how to make pizza, I will sell you a pizza, but I will still make me a pizza.
So it sounds to me like if they have an active bounty out trying to get people to crack it, if you're, I don't know, say targeting banks in various South American and Central American countries to maybe, I don't know, appropriate funds from people who are appropriating funds from various businesses and governments and want to keep that information hidden, Monero might be a way of getting the money out without getting shot by the mob. Just as a thought. Don't anybody actually target, you know, like criminal organizations and hacking banks? That seems like a great way to get yourself killed.
But it sounds like if you want to do business online and don't want to be watched,
Monero's right now, a way to go. Monero's until
the
this...
one to go.
Yeah, somebody watched the proposal.
Believe... Yeah, I do believe that's IRS approved.
Actually, from the way this reads, it sounds like all you have to have is a really good write-up and a company name and maybe an email address. I guess a fax machine, it's the IRS. Because you can get $500,000 just to get started. And then after, you know, the due date comes up, it's like, sorry, didn't work, weren't able to make it happen. You know, you just accept the failure. I mean, there'll probably be strings attached that you have to refund anything you haven't used after the 8 month. But, I mean, it almost sounds like you could just submit a claim to the IRS. You know, for, I think I've got something that might work, you know, fill it full of Star Trek technobabble and see if you can get them to give you the $500,000 for your startup. Oh, fuck, that might actually work. When's that thing due? The 16th? Madman, think we can bullshit a document together in the next 3 days?
I have tomorrow off.
I'm not saying we actually have to succeed. We just have to make the IRS think it might succeed. Oh, it's probably 10 tons of illegal to do that, isn't it?
Probably.
It's only fraud. But they have fraud to prove that it's fraud.
Well, we could make a legitimate go at it. I mean, we just know it's not going to succeed. Anyways. Anybody have anything on this, or... Two things for you tonight in Digital Dojo. The first is this interesting Twitter automation platform. put out by this guy called Michael Flea. And here's his blog post on it. It's called Semispherical. And the idea is you give it an API key to your Twitter account and then set a schedule. And it'll go in and delete everything outside of your schedule. So, you know, you can set some rules. Basically, anything older than a certain date, delete it. So, like, you can say just every 128 days, anything older than that, delete it. Flag specific tweets you never want to delete. Delete all retweets and likes that are older than a week. What other examples do you have? Keep tweets that have a certain number of likes. So there's two versions of it, right? He's got the version he's hosting. You know, it's a hosted service that you can sign up with and feed it your Twitter API key, set your rules, and it'll just go in and clean up your Twitter account. So if you're actually using Twitter and you don't want somebody pulling up tweets from 6 years ago that are now deemed to be an ist of some sort, because that's happened to how many people now where they pull up some tweet from 10 years ago and Chris Rock can't host a show anymore or something like that?
Yep.
Just as an example. So I have, you know, something like Twitter, which is supposed to be this conversational service anyways, unless you're trying to make an archive, it's probably a good idea to clear out anything that's older than a certain amount. But the cool thing is it's open source. So if you don't want to trust this guy's service, you can set up your own.
Anything now, older than yesterday.
Why not? Turn Twitter into a chatbot. I mean, but it's open source, so you can go on the GitHub, get the service, and run your own, so you don't have to trust him. So just the fact that the source code is available makes his service a lot more trustworthy, because he's like, here's the code. Go run your own if you want. I mean, in my mind, that's awesome. I don't actually use Twitter, so I don't care, but I still think it's cool. And anybody else who's actually using Twitter, I think it's something that I keep in mind. Which means I should probably go back and delete the archives of all of our shows after a certain date. It's like, how you know, where go back, you can only get the last 5 Pure Deckings, and IHN and all the other shows, they're just gone. You can't get those anymore. You know? That might be wise, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm ready for the war to start. We're good.
Oh, my.
Fair enough.
Done waiting, man.
Getting a little antsy.
I'm not just fucking sick of waiting, man. Like, I don't know how to queue like the next socialist, but shit.
So, anyways... And the last thing I have for you tonight in Dojo is a project called Relativity. It is a open source VR headset. It's based around a Amtel SAM 3X8E ARM Cortex M3 processor. And pretty much there's an Arduino build that already runs this, but you could get the bare board and put it together for like $25. The screens are about $200 on AliExpress for the ones they use in the project. It's open source. The idea is you get the electronics, you 3D print the case. I'm assuming you got to figure out some lenses somewhere. I don't remember seeing that when I was skimming it before. Supposedly it's compatible with Steam VR. Don't know about controllers, but they were using positional scanning based on video input. So it's still a little bit early days, still a little bit experimental. And they're flat out saying, we're not making a product. It's open source. You want one of these, you have to build it. But if you want to get into VR and you don't want to have to set up a Facebook account with Oculus, here's a way to go.
Yeah, I was thinking that's probably really good that it's open source like that. Considering everything's going behind an account now for most others.
Yeah.
I think the software that they're developing could be, I don't know, applied to an Oculus?
No, probably not. Just simply because I doubt it's the same architecture. Now, that said, I don't doubt that at some point you're going to see jailbreaks and other third-party software you might be able to put on, like a Galaxy Quest or Oculus Quest. Galaxy Quest is just a movie, an awesome movie, but it's a movie, not a headset. The Oculus Quest or some of the other headsets that are floating around out there, some of the older ones, I don't doubt that at some point there'll be jailbreaks. I mean, actually, the Quest already is because you can root the Android install below it. But, you know, maybe somebody will decide to write their own software so it's outside of the Oculus system at some point. You never know. Usually a device gets popular enough, somebody figures that out. But this one's just cool because, again, you could order the parts, build it for a couple hundred bucks, and if you got a 3D printer, there you go. So, they're using just video scanning based off webcams, I think. They're saying the precision and freedom of movement is very far from dedicated sensors, but they're working on it. So it's still very early days on this thing, but it's a cool project, though.
Yeah.
That's all I got for tonight. Hey, we're like right at an hour.
Yeah.
Damn,
yeah.
We can do it. It is an hour show. We've proven it.
So, real quick, blazing through the closing promos. Listen to the stream. We're always working on a Galaxy or Pure Decking every Thursday. Galaxy 15 Radio Site, the subreddit, and the IRC tonight. Myself, Sard, Cyberlord, Cykros, DPView, Madman, and the Coffee Maker. Madman, closing thoughts.
Cykros actually here? I don't think he said anything the entire show, and that's not him.
No, nobody said anything the entire show. I imagine that they've left their machine signed into the IRC at some point in the past and forgot to log out. Closing thoughts?
I don't really have anything this week. I'm just going to be doing a lot of reading next week as I got the internal documents on policy and procedure. Jeez, fuck, it's going to be a hell of a read. That's the internal, not the external. Sorry for him. Bosses only.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Tomsko nose down and call the night.
Shut up, Wesley.